Welcome to Word Balloon. This is John Saunders. Today, writer Dwayne McDuffie talks to us about his work as producer and story editor of the Warner Brothers animated television series, Justice League Unlimited. Fans love the show and wonder why Cartoon Network hasn't scheduled new episodes since September. Dwayne provides a behind-the-scenes look at the rest of Season 5, plus we'll talk about his comic book work at Marvel, including his new Fantastic Four special, released December 29th. Our conversation begins with Dwayne's first regular comic series for Marvel, a late 80s revival of Deathlok.
Oh, Deathlok was really fun. Marvel was toying with doing revamps of a lot of their characters. Ghost Rider, Deathlok, a couple of others were suggested. And myself and Greg Wright put together a pitch for a Deathlok miniseries, and we did it. And it sold great. I mean, really, really much better than anybody had expected. And they made it a regular monthly comic, and it was the first really ongoing thing I was ever involved in.
Now, this was a different character than Luther, am I correct?
Yes, this wasn't Luther Manning. This was Mike Collins.
Okay.
Who was a brand new character. I loved Deathlok when I was a kid, and I didn't want to step on it.
Okay.
And the problem with the old Deathlok at the time, Deathlok was a 70s comic,
mm-hmm.
and it was set in the far-flung future of 1985. So when we started working on this in 87, we knew by that point that New York wasn't overrun by cannibals and, you know, people didn't have laser guns. So we sort of had to come up with an explanation for that. But we also wanted a clean start. So we started with a new character, and there were plans to reveal over time what the connection was with the old one. And that actually didn't get done until I was off the book, but they did eventually tie it all together.
Would you ever want to get back to Deathlok?
Oh, I'd love to get back to Deathlok. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw, if not Deathlok, if we saw Mike Collins again.
Okay.
That's kind of a hint.
That's cool. I hope that happens. Do you have any comic book plans coming up? I know you're steeped in animation right now, but...
Well, actually, this week, the first comic book I've done for Marvel in about 13 years came out, a Fantastic Four one-shot called Fantastic Four Special Number 1.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize you had done that. Okay.
And that was pretty cool. Tom Brevoort, the editor, just sort of emailed me out of the blue because I'm always complaining in interviews that nobody ever asked me to do comics anymore. And he emails me and he says, "Oh, you want to do one?" So I was kind of stuck. But I love the Fantastic Four. I always wanted to write them. And Tom had this great pitch, the idea being that Dr. Doom and Reed Richards sit down for dinner and have a conversation about their lives. And that's what he gave me. It was really, really fun coming up with the excuse for it. And it worked out really nicely. Some really, really nice Casey Jones art. It was a lot of fun.
That's very cool. And that seems to be in your wheelhouse, too, given some of your other books. And I want to get to Damage Control, because what a great concept. Just a great odd duck of a book that really makes perfect sense. So for people who don't know about Damage Control, explain it.
Damage Control is an insurance and engineering firm that specializes in superhero problems. In practical terms, they clean up when Hulk and Thor have a fight in Midtown Manhattan and wreck it. You know, next issue, everything's fine. Damage Control is the company that comes in and fixes it all. And it really was sort of an early take on how does this stuff affect real people in the world. Although it was played for comedy, you know, we always treat the characters seriously. We never made fun of the Marvel characters. They behaved as they behaved in their own books. It's just, the thing isn't always fighting Dr. Doom. Sometimes he's trying to get his insurance claim approved.
And I also like just the inspiration from what I read on your website behind it, too, from the Batman series.
Oh, yeah, it's true. There was an episode of the old Batman TV show, the Adam West one, that none of your listeners is old enough to remember, which was sort of a campy comedic take on Batman that I really enjoyed as a kid and didn't understand was campy and comedic. There's an episode where Batman has to make a U-turn very quickly, and a parachute comes out the back of the Batmobile, and they do this, you know, really cool U-turn, and it drops the parachute, and they cut to this little truck, and it says Bat Parachute Pickup and Delivery Service. And the truck comes over, and they pick up the parachute and leave. And it struck me that this is these guys' job. They wait for Batman to make a U-turn. And it really wasn't much of a stretch from there, you know?
No, it's a great call, man. And again, just a great idea for a fun book. It's strange. I wonder if now not to put a pall on it, but really in this post 9/11 world, can you do damage control and still have the wacky fun of what you were doing? I thought it was great.
I think so. Buildings were getting knocked down before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it certainly was a sensitive topic at the time.
Sure.
You know, but this is fiction, and nobody's really getting hurt. You know, it's a story. As a matter of fact, they do a little damage control cameo in my Fantastic Four special, and they've been popping up around the Marvel Universe every once in a while now.
That's very cool, and the Fantastic Four story sounds great. And yeah, a good opportunity for you to get into the characters of Reed and Victor Von Doom. And there is that dynamic that I always love that doesn't seem to be as exploited as it should, the fact that these two guys have known each other for most of their adult life. And it's kind of that same thing with, you know, the pre-crisis Superman and Lex Luthor.
I was going to say, that's something that I miss. I mean, I like the current version better, but I really do miss that aspect of Superman and Lex Luthor being friends since they were in high school and actually starting as friends. And, you know, the reason that Lex Luthor hated Superman in the comics is it's hysterical. Superboy was, he was trying to cure him? He was trying to come with a kryptonite cure. So Superboy builds him this great lab, blows out a fire, the chemicals get on his hair, and he goes bald. And it's like, now you are my enemy forever.
Friendship's over, man.
And you know what? When you compare that to the motivations of guys trying to take over the world, I don't get that, but I get you made me bald.
And guys like Elliot Majan, too, really, I think, exploited it well, because you're my age, Dwayne, so I'm sure you remember that great novel, the two novels.
I remember Miracle Monday. Right?
Yes, and Last Son of Krypton was
one. Yeah, I read that one too.
And both of those, yeah, they really, you know, again, I mean, you just knew, these two guys knew each other.
Yeah, no question.
And could push each other's buttons. And I mean, and that made the tension between them even better, I guess.
Can't argue with it all.
Let's,
you made me show my nerd credentials, man. This is bad.
Now, anyone can go to your website, Dwayne, and see. You know, you are one of us. Let's not forget that. That's all right. I wanted to ask about Milestone. I was surprised when I heard your interview just earlier this month on Comic Zone to hear that Static was the lowest selling of the Milestone books.
It was the lowest selling of the original four. I think some of the books we tried in the later years may have done worse.
Okay.
But out of the initial four, it was never... I don't think it was ever in third place, you know,
okay,
out of the four. I think the timing may have been wrong because... Everybody was into, you know, how dark and gritty can we be? And Static was fun.
And yeah, and I think played to your strengths as a writer, and I would say the same thing about Damage Control as well. I wonder if a lot of those books wouldn't have done better today, because it is more of a writer's arena now than it was in the late 80s, early 90s, that image period as well, where the artists really ruled.
Well, you know, it's weird, because we weren't a writer's company. The Ultraverse was sort of a writer's company, and Image was an artist company.
Mm-hmm.
And we were a storytelling company. I mean, we really, the writer and the artist sort of had to check their ego and work together to tell stories. And that's what we were about. You know, we didn't feel like either side of it should drive it. Comics is the synthesis of the two. And right then, everybody was really excited at, like, all these new cool printing processes and how cool the art looked, and it brought a lot of energy and excitement into the medium, and that's what was going on then, and we were just doing something else.
How did you get into animation?
Blind luck. What happened was a bunch of the guys who worked on Batman the Animated Series,
mm-hmm,
were Milestone fans and had pitched Milestone shows many times. We came close to selling a team show back in 93, and the guy who wrote that, Alan Burnett, was one of the primary Batman writer producers.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't work, but he had to read a bunch of Milestone to do that, and he got into it and had been pitching it for years. And one year they said, yeah, okay, let's do this. Let's do Static. And I got a phone call after they had done a couple episodes saying, hey, you know, you ought to try writing one of these. It was pretty easy for me. I actually find it easier to write animation than I do comics, just technically. Static led to more episodes of Static. Paul Dini hurt his hand after writing an outline for an episode of Justice League, and somebody suggested me. And they liked my Justice League, and they gave me a couple more. And actually, Justice League hired me as a story editor, and that's when I moved to California. And I've been there ever since.
Now, I wanted to ask, comparing a 21-minute cartoon script with a 22-page comic, which has more room for a complete story?
You know what? I don't really think it works that way. I think there's room for a complete story in either one of them, but they're different kinds of stories. You know, comics used to have complete stories in 17 pages, 11
pages. Yes, they
did. It was just the way, the storytelling style. It's very, very rare that you get done in one comics anymore. But it's not because there isn't room. It's because we have different tastes, and we're building things for trade paperback, mm-hmm. and all of those make a lot of sense. It's just a different world. Same thing with animation. We did complete stories in a half an hour, and we did season 4 of Justice League, which is pretty much one story,
yep.
13 episodes. So it's the kind of story you choose to tell and the storytelling methods.
Do you like the decompressed comic book stories these days?
You know, I like individual stories. I don't know that whether it's decompressed or not has anything to do with if I like it.
Okay.
It just has to be a satisfying experience for me. And if it's really, really decompressed and it takes an entire panel, I mean, it takes an entire issue for the glass that somebody drops to hit the floor and break, if I'm entertained by that, that's great. If somebody wants to hit that in a line of dialogue and get going, that's great, too.
See, it seems now that it really is, you hear the phrase all the time, writing for the trade, where it seems like that is dictating how long a story is rather than actually, you know, how long the writer really feels he could probably tell the story.
Okay, but you know what? Economics and distribution always dictated how long the story was.
Okay.
When comic book stories were 17 pages, you know, you wrote 17-page stories.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote a story that was appropriate for that number of pages, and you told it in a style where it fit in that period of pages. Some of those stories were padded, too. And
sure.
Some of those stories were too full. And some trade paperback stories are padded, and some trade paperback stories are too full. Like, you know, they said do 6 issues because the trade's 6 issues long, and you've got 9 issues worth of stuff, and you just do it anyway. Or you've only got 4 issues worth of stuff, and they say do 6, and you pad it to make it go 6. But that's not any different from when you were writing 22-page stories, 11-page stories, whatever.
How did you handle, in your miniseries, you know, dealing with each individual issue? Because I can appreciate what you're saying, too, that obviously the trade paperback might be the most profitable model for a company to make its money back on a story.
Like what miniseries?
Well, just in general, in terms of, you know, it just seems like sometimes an issue ends in a multi-issue story just because you've hit, you know, a writer has hit 22 pages.
Yeah, I think a lot of that is adjustment. I think people are trying to figure it out.
Okay.
And some people have figured it out really well. And I've sort of got old school instincts with that sort of thing where mm-hmm. I sort of feel like a 22-page story should have some kind of button. Even if it's a continued story, it should be like a splash page of, it's Dr. Doom, you know, something. But there are people who feel that that's not naturalistic, and when you put it together in the trade, that, you know, trade collections of old comics feel like that. You know, you read, and then there's a big stop, and then you start over, and they tell you what you just saw, and you read. And that's not satisfying either. So these guys are trying to find a balance between the individual issues and what they see as the final product, which is the book. And people have a different opinion about how much of that you need, and I'm not sure who's right.
Well, and like I think you're right too when you say that it depends on the story.
Yep.
You know, tell me about the mechanics of writing an animation script versus writing a comic book.
Well, I haven't been in comics for a long time. The thing about comics is that, at least in my experience, is what you end up with is a lot closer to what you intended when you started because there are fewer filters. You know, when you write a comic, you basically have to convince the editor, and if you're writing a monthly comic, you don't even have to convince the editor every month. When you write a TV show, you've got a story editor, and you've got a producer, and you've got executives at the studio, and you've got executives at the network, and these are all people who have to be satisfied before they spend amounts of money that are staggering to put this thing on, you know. A comic book, you're not investing 10% of the money that you're investing in a episode of a TV show.
Sure.
So the stakes are smaller, so you get to do more of what you want to do. But basically, it's pitching a story to an editor or to a story editor on a TV show. It's getting them to agree to it. It's developing it. It's writing an outline of some sort. This is what's going to happen. Going back and forth over that. You go from outline to script. And it's breaking the outline down in either, you know, panels, if it's a comic book and pages, or in real time, if it's an animation script.
Okay.
Again, technically, I find animation scripts much easier to write than comics. Comics, you have to make a decision every moment about what am I going to show and how much of it. In animation, you just write what happens. You don't have to pick the instant. Now, that's the magic of comics, but that's the technically difficult part, too.
Tell me about other writers that you guys have gotten on Teen Titans and JLU that have come on to do animation. There's Dino J.M. DeMatteis.
Yeah, well, you know, Mark was a TV writer long before I was, so
okay.
It was kind of weird having him work for me when, like, he actually knows how to do it, and I was still figuring it out. But we had a lot of guys. We had Steranko come in with a story.
Great episode.
Gail Simone.
Yep.
Actually, this season, Jeff Johns has done an episode for us.
Oh, terrific.
I am missing important people, and I hope they don't get mad at me.
Well, Marv Wolfman and Warren Ellis, I know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And they were all great stories. And also, I enjoyed the fact that you guys are adapting some of the comic book stories. There's the obvious one, the man who has had everything, the great Alan Moore story.
Yeah, that was really fun. That sort of came out of a conversation with Bruce Timm and James Tucker, the other producers on the show. And Bruce was sort of, you know, we really haven't done a Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman story. You know, we haven't done a Trinity story. We should kind of sit around and try and think of one. And I was like, you know, I love For the Man Who Has Everything. Why don't we just adapt it? And everybody was into it. And Bruce contacted Alan Moore because we didn't want to, you know, do it if he wasn't into it.
It's sure.
It wasn't a question of rights. We had the rights, but it was respect for what he's done.
Certainly.
And he was cool with it. And show worked out very, very well. In fact, I hated losing Robin, who we didn't use. But the weird thing about it was, the one thing about that story that always bothered me was Wonder Woman just gets her behind kicked, and she doesn't really help. You know,
sure.
Batman helps Superman escape, Superman defeats the bad guy, Wonder Woman basically gets her butt handed to her. And what was nice about this was she got to solve the problem, so she was an equal part of the team. So, although we did lose Think Clean Thoughts, old chum, my favorite line ever.
Great scene, absolutely.
You know, but we did gain, I think, more of a balance between the three big stars.
That's a hallmark of your guys' show, especially Justice League, where you guys have really given, you know, real respect to Hawkgirl, Wonder Woman, Vixen. I mean, Vixen, for God's sakes, one of the JL Detroit. And you guys have really turned her into this really cool character, exceeding anything that happened in the comic books, in my opinion.
Well, we get to pay attention to them sort of directly. When we do an episode about a character, particularly a character we've never done before, we think about it really hard, and we think about how we're going to present them. And it's more of a focus on them. A lot of the characters that, you know, we've done really well with are characters who've never really been the focus of anything. They've been on a team, in a team book that has big stars in it, and you service your stars. But the shape of the show, and the shape of actually every version of the show, has been secondary characters have to stand equal with Batman and Superman. We have to treat them with the same respect, and we have a lot more time to really think about it and develop it and do what we want to do with it.
I think that's great, because that was one of my concerns when you guys went from the two-part episodes into, as you say, season four was a kind of a season-long story, but each individual episode really stood on its own as well. And it was so nice to see that you guys were able to achieve in, you know, with commercials away, 20 minutes, a really detailed, in-depth story that featured both action and characterization.
Yeah, I wasn't sure it was going to work. Initially, I thought every week we're going to have one of the original seven go off on a mission with one or two characters that people don't know, and we'll really focus on the new characters and sort of introduce them. That was the plan. As we started doing it, we realized that we could do a lot more in 20 minutes than we thought we could. And once we realized that, you know, we can have five, six characters around and really service them and have interesting things happen and not have it just be, you know, they all show up and they fight and they win in the end, the show started to get really interesting for me. We could have done another season with the Big Seven, and it would have been great, but JLU just turned into something unlike any any superhero series I've ever seen.
I completely agree as a fan. It's so great because every episode kind of provides its own Easter eggs, too. And you guys clearly are just throwing so much eye candy for everyone just to get into, especially hardcore DC fans. I mean, to see Nemesis, a character that, you know, I don't think anybody younger than, you know, me probably remembers.
Yeah, I actually didn't know who he was. I was Nemesis stumped me. So I went and read, you know, I think I read James Tucker's copies of those old stories. I was like, oh, okay.
It was an Aztec.
Yeah, Aztec was fun.
Even just seeing Vibe walk by in the satellite, which is more than enough Vibe, personally. But no, it's honestly so much fun. And another thing, and I want to get into this, the voice casting that you guys do for this show is fantastic because you got some heavyweight character actors. CeCe Pounder, Dennis Haysbert, Ron Perlman, Brad Garrett, Terrence Stamp, Roscoe Lee Brown, David Warner, all these guys are showing up on these Warner animated shows, and they bring, you know, real depth to these characters when you hear them speak.
Well, what's nice about it, Andrea Romano is the voice director, who is one of a handful of true geniuses I've ever had the privilege of meeting in person. You know, I mean, it's just, she operates at a whole nother level. You know, this is not cartoon acting, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that that's how she's going to treat the material makes us work harder on the scripts. We bring that, it brings the scripts up. The actors bring stuff to the characters that isn't on the page, and then when we go back and do the character again, then we incorporate it, and it's this really nice thing that feeds itself and just makes the shows better.
How often are more than one actor at a time able to get together and do their voice tracks?
Almost always.
Oh, that's great.
It's done pretty much like a radio play.
That's fantastic.
You know, there's a couple run-throughs, and then they sit in the booth, and we go in order, and then we go off and kind of talk about it, and we'll punch in things that didn't quite work, or we've got a different line, or we want a different take on it. But usually they're all there.
So you're in on those sessions as well as the story
editor? Yeah, it's great.
Wow, yeah, that has to be great. So how long does it take from a voice standpoint to get like a scratch track in terms of, you know, getting everybody together and having something ready?
It's usually the entire morning or the entire afternoon.
Okay.
For an episode.
I want to go back to another one of the adapted stories that you specifically got credit for. That's Hereafter, the Superman.
Oh yeah, that was so weird. Rich Fogel, who was the producer that year, had always wanted to do Superman Under a Red Sun.
Yep.
And I don't remember who wanted to do a Death of Superman story. That might have been Rich, too. And then he had the insane idea, let's just do them both. So, you know, I kind of thought about that for a while. And what was nice was we got to do a Death of Superman story. And this is actually it goes back to something you were talking about before, doing the adaptation. I think it's generally really boring to do a straight adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the people who care about it, they already know how it's going to work out. But I do like taking the ideas and sort of spinning off of them. So the idea of how the Justice League and the world reacts when Superman dies is really cool. Having him and Doomsday pound on each other for an entire episode until he dies probably wouldn't have been that interesting an episode. So we had to kind of come up with another way to do it. It's the same thing. Superman Under a Red Sun is a pretty cool story, but
Absolutely.
It's also an older story that isn't contemporary in a lot of ways, but the core of it was really good, and that's what we went with, and then we found a way to tie it in with our continuity pretty well, and that worked out really nicely.
Well, and you know, I think it takes writers like yourself, and I've had this conversation with guys like Mark Waid as well, and you guys seem to are able to get into the core of, as you say, a really interesting story from the 60s, from that pre-crisis era, from the Silver Age. You know,
there's nothing wrong with those stories. They're really strong stories. It's just we're used to a different style now. It's like watching movies in the 30s, and they're really strong dramatically, but the style of acting and the style of camera movement and the pace makes it hard for somebody who grew up, you know, in the 80s to sit there.
Sure.
But you take the same story, or you take the same elements, and you tell it in a contemporary fashion, and everything that was good about it in the 60s is still good about it, but it's appropriate to people who are used to watching stuff now.
Well, I think you guys achieved it. I think, I think this was a really entertaining season that wrapped up season four, especially the final episode as well. Was that your idea from the start in terms of...
That idea predated me probably watching Batman. That was an idea that I know Bruce Timm always wanted to do. Basically, it was the discovery of the true origins of the Batman of the future, Terry McGinnis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to spoil it.
Certainly. No, I understand.
But it was an idea that he had had for a direct-to-video that was going to follow up Return of the Joker. And they never got around to doing it. And a lot of things came together, and one of them was we thought we were done. We thought that was going to be the last episode in that entire continuity, going from Batman the Animated Series through Superman through Justice League through Justice League Unlimited. And we sort of saw it as a way that we could tie together all those elements and kind of give a last wave to the fans, which is the reason that the last sequence in Epilogue, the episode we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
is shot for shot a reverse of the first sequence in Batman the Animated Series on Leather Wings.
Oh, that's cool. And I got to get grabbed by DVD when we're done it.
So, you know, instead of Man-Bat flying around, it was actually Batman flying around.
That's really cool. And also, I love the visual tricks that you guys got into in that episode as well. Going to black and white on flashbacks and you know, I mean, every show was in letterbox, but it just seemed like an even...
Oh, no, it was super letterbox. There were two things going on. The black and white sequences were actually fantasy sequences that Terry was having, and then there were also flashbacks. So we had widescreen for flashbacks, and we had black and white, super widescreen for the fantasy. And, man, that black and white footage just looked beautiful.
Absolutely. I mean, and again, a hallmark for all these Warner Brothers shows. You guys really, both from a story standpoint and visually and the voice acting, these are incredible productions, and... You know, have been hailed a million times. I'm sure you guys have just won just tons of awards for.
The visual talent on those shows is just stunning. The artists are amazing. The directors are amazing. The editors are amazing. And I'm so spoiled to come in and work with guys like that the first time. And I wonder, like, as my career moves forward, will I ever work with that many people who are that good again?
No, I hear you. And also a nod to CeCe Pounder, who really, you know, did a great Amanda Waller. I mean,
I adore her.
You know, John Ostrander, I had him on a couple months ago, and we talked about it, and he was thrilled as well. I mean,
oh, I'm glad. I haven't talked to him about how he felt about it, because we had to twist her a little bit, you know, to make
sure.
Her work for our story. But boy, the idea that a woman is going to stand up to Batman repeatedly, you know, you really needed somebody who could blow, because Kevin Conroy's voice is unbelievable.
Absolutely.
And you needed somebody who could stand toe-to-toe with him and not get blown out of the scene. And I think we succeeded.
So what's going on right now with the current season? Because it's such a, you know, patchwork of, okay, here's a few episodes, and then we're going away for a few months. Can you tell me what's going on?
Yeah, right now we're on hiatus. They ran the first four episodes. We don't know when we're coming back on.
Wow.
But Cartoon Network schedules their own stuff, so we just make them and then they run them when they're ready to run them. And at some point, you know, I'll probably read on the internet, because I always hear on the internet before I actually hear officially. We'll be back on the schedule. I can promise you a very strong season. You probably know we're doing Legion of Doom this year.
Yeah, I saw the first episode. I missed the other three, but I did see the first one.
Well, that's a developing storyline, and let's see, we've got the Legion of Superheroes coming up.
Very cool.
The Fatal Five in that episode. We've got Dead Man.
Who's playing Dead Man?
Oh, embarrass me.
Oh, I'm sorry. And that's the great thing, again. I mean, it's like, oh, my God, what do you mean? Brad Garrett is Lobo? I mean, could anyone do Lobo better than Brad Garrett?
Oh, no, that was hysterical. And it's really weird because, you know, I'm a very tall guy.
Uh-huh.
And I'm always... sort of disappointed when I meet celebrities, because they're never as big as I think they are. He's huge.
You're 6'7", so he's bigger than you?
He's bigger than me.
Wow.
I mean, he's bigger than he looks on the show.
That's cool. And you know, how much, like, do you ever talk to some of these actors in terms of, like, how they get into, like, the character?
Yeah, we talk to them, and, you know, we sit around between takes and talk about the character. I mean, most of these guys are really good, and they have the script, and sometimes they'll have questions. But Andrea's so good at that, it's really rare where we really need to say anything to them.
Okay.
Unless there's something in our head we want them to try specifically.
Okay.
But everybody's a pro. Everybody's really good at their job. People are incredibly friendly and down to earth, you know? They just sort of walk in and talk about their kids and then go do the show and see you next week, you know?
Okay, now you got to out a few comic book fans in that actor's core. Who surprised you as being like, oh, I already know this character?
The biggest surprise to me was Peter McNichol, who played Kronos for us.
Okay.
And I did sort of really weird take on Kronos. He walks in wearing a Mr. X t-shirt.
Okay.
And I'm like, you are hardcore.
No kidding.
And he was amazing, just gave an amazing performance in that.
I wish
we hadn't killed the character off or gotten rid of the character because I'd just like to work with him again.
Was that the time travel episode?
Yeah, that was the time travel episode.
That was another great two-parter. First of all, great way to work in Hal Jordan real fast.
Yeah, you know, people are like, when are we going to see Hal? When are we going to see Hal? I'm like, okay, here's Hal. Leave me alone.
But even better, honestly, the adult static just was fantastic.
That was a lot of fun for me. It was really, that was Bruce Timm's idea. Everybody thinks, cause, you know, I was one of the creators of Static, like I made them. But we were trying to think, okay, who would be in the Justice League? Who would be the last survivors? Who would be really interesting? And we needed Warhawk, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we needed Terry McGinnis because the whole fun was going to see our Batman and the future Batman interact.
Yep.
As well as very old Bruce Wayne, which is just a ton of fun to write.
Those are great scenes.
And we're trying to think of people, and everybody's kicking ideas in, and it's like, well, Big Barda was there before. She's fun, but she's kind of too much like Wonder Woman. And Bruce says, what about Static? And I wanted to say, yeah, you know, but I had to be cool. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting idea. I wouldn't be opposed to that. You know, I'm jumping up and down in the corner. And it worked out very nicely.
And you gave Static the nice little highlight, too. I forget the specific bit of business he did, but he showed his power. He stood right in line, man. He was on the front line and looking good.
Oh, yeah, they were all pros. They're all good superheroes.
And I loved his dreads, too. I loved his gray dreads.
His gray dreads. Yeah, he had my favorite line, which was 65 is the new 30.
That's right. And also, man, what a great talent Phil LaMarr is to go from...
Oh, Phil is another comic book freak.
There you go.
Phil knows more about comics than I do. Very often when we're recording, he'll have a stack of comic books that he's reading until it's time for him to act.
Well, that's great. That's fantastic. And he's done so many things like Free Enterprise, you know, those kind of just geek shit kind of...
Yeah, he's in Barbershop now.
He's in the new Barbershop. That's cool.
Yeah, he was a regular on Mad TV. He was
yes,
a UPS guy. And probably most infamously, he's the guy who gets his brains blown out in the back of the car in Pulp Fiction.
That's Marvin.
And it's not that he can do all these voices. It's not just that, you know, he can be Static, who's this high-pitched teenager, and Green Lantern, who's, you know, voices deeper than Darth Vader's.
Yep.
And things people don't know, he's also Stripe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean,
wow.
People are always saying, well, Phil LaMarr, I guess he's every black voice on the show. It's like, no, he's every voice on every show, not just the black guy.
Wow.
But it's not just that he can do all those voices, it's that he's an amazing actor. The thing is that he can do a voice as broad as Green Lantern's voice and put all kinds of shades of real emotion in it. A lot of the scenes that he does with Maria Canal, who plays a Hawk Girl,
mm-hmm.
are just exquisitely acted, you know. It made us go for things that we wouldn't have gone for in a standard cartoon with, you know, standard cartoon voices. I love these guys.
Well, and again, it is evidence in the stories that you guys write. Starcross, the three-parter, where Hawkman comes back, and the old Hawkman, your version of the old Hawkman, I should say, the Thanagarian Hawkman. But, yeah, I mean, there's real heartache in these things, and very adult themes in a Y7 rated show Do you guys ever get any notes from the network?
Well, we get network notes.
Saying that you can't go there or anything?
There's things we can't do. I mean, like showing blood.
Okay.
Some like physical contact stuff that's maybe too cruel. But they are really, really great with us. They've given us... We do stuff every week that I don't think is going to go. I'm always the guy in the story meeting going, they're not going to let us do that. What are you, nuts? You know, say, oh, well, let's try it and see if they let us go. And they're like, oh, no problem. Go ahead.
That's really impressive. And, I mean, they clearly know that they're getting this significant adult audience.
Well, you know, they do, but we also have a really big kid audience. I mean, people pay so much attention to the adult audience that I think they don't realize how many kids watch the show. And it's a very, very popular show among kids and adults, which is great.
Well, that's good, because I think there is concern on the fans' part, especially with the herky-jerkiness of this season so far, wondering in terms of, you know, do they like the show? And you know how the Internet gets, where rumors run rampant.
Look, nobody knows anything. and when nobody knows anything, you know, people start to fill the vacuum, right?
Exactly. That's the concern. And also that, I mean, you know, obviously a credit to what you guys are doing, because we all love it. We just want more. And, you know, I mean, is there a potential sixth season, or is this going to be it?
Well, we really don't know. It's like every season we find out whether we're getting picked up pretty much as we're putting together the last episode.
Okay.
But because there's been the delay in showing them, you know, how can the network make a decision? They don't know how the ratings are because they've only shown four episodes.
Right.
So they'll make that decision at some point in the future based on how the rest of the season goes. And it's a good season.
Oh, definitely. I'm also surprised that it's only now that in 2006 we're finally going to see the DVD sets coming out.
Well, it took them a while to get around to it, but, you know, they're doing a great job. I can't wait for the season sets of Justice League. You know, I always felt like they should be out that way. But they were doing really well as individual DVDs that, you know, people were buying for their kids. So it's kind of hard for you to move from one thing that's successful to something else that might be successful.
Well, that's true. And I guess that's what they did with the Batman animated series as well.
Yeah.
So I can understand that. Has Static come out yet in seasons?
The first half of the first season came out. That's the only one we've had so far, so people should go buy a whole bunch.
Okay.
I need a set, because I tape mine off the air and they don't look that great.
Great stuff. And again, another hallmark of this group of Warner Brothers animation people that put together a solidly written show with great acting and just great stories.
I'm really, really proud of Static. We ran 52 episodes. We were at the top of the Saturday morning ratings for the last 2 years of the show on Kids WB. Then we went on Cartoon Network, and for months, we were the number two show on Cartoon Network, right behind Family Guy.
That's outstanding.
You know, four Emmy nominations, a Humanitas Prize. I couldn't be prouder.
That's very cool. I want to get back to another specific Justice League episode of yours, Wake the Dead. That had to have been a Defenders homage.
You think, maybe? Actually, the first one, I just kind of went there a little more the second time, but what was the first one we did with those characters?
Because I guess really it was when
The Terror Beyond.
Okay.
That was the first one, and then that was Bruce's idea.
Now, was that the one where they go to Dr. Fate?
Dr. Fate is basically Dr. Strange.
Certainly.
Man, I'm going to get like a nasty call from the PR people. Dr. Fate... is Doctor Strange, and Grundy is the Hulk.
Certainly.
And Aquaman's obviously the Submariner. And it just seems so clear now. But I had written a couple of drafts of that before somebody mentioned to me that it was supposed to be kind of a wink at the Defenders.
Oh, no kidding.
And I was like, why do you want these characters in it?
Did
I
don't
get it. What's the connection between it? And Bruce says, they're the Defenders. And I'm like,
So Hawkgirl was kind of that Hellcat Valkyrie kind of combination.
I mean, you know, I didn't want to even take it that far. I was thinking about the first three. I've seen people's brilliant theories about Superman's the Silver Surfer and all this stuff, but I wasn't really thinking about that. If it's there, it's there. But I was really thinking about the three original Defenders. And by the time we got to Wake the Dead, you know, I was really having fun with it and Bird Nose and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But
and Amazo is. I mean, Amazo certainly.
Amazo certainly the Silver Surfer. Yeah. I guess. But, you know, I mean, It was just like a little wink and nod.
It was wonderful. It was a great story. Hell, if anything, you know, Quesada should be calling you up to do the follow-up to DeMattis's defenders.
Did you hear that, Joe?
Exactly. No kidding, man.
But hey, the Hulk killed Cthulhu. How cool is that?
Good stuff.
Hit him in the head.
Very cool stuff. Well, and you got the Fantastic Four thing. Is there more on the horizon as far as comic stuff?
Nothing I can announce, but okay. I've been talking to Tom Brevoort about doing some more stuff, and I'm confidence is high. It's a pretty cool idea.
They should be banging your door down, man, because, no kidding, again, as evidenced by these television shows, you know what you're doing in this world. I mean, you really, and you always have. I mean, again, going back, XO, you know, Man of War, and stuff like that as well.
Oh, that was just a blast. I really enjoyed doing that, XO. That was a shame. That company was doing a lot of really great books then, and it was just where the market was, you know.
Did you work directly with Shooter on those books?
No, I worked with Shooter back when it was Valiant.
Okay.
And he had moved on. I actually worked on XO under Fabian, who was their last editor in chief when
okay.
they did the reboot,
mm-hmm.
Birthquake or something like that. And I just took over. I did the last five issues of the series, and I had just done a reboot, and they're like, okay, we're done. You know.
That's too bad.
Which was sad, because I really, there's this character, supporting character in XO named Renata, who's his wacky platonic girlfriend, who's just one of the all-time great character creations, and I think that was Mark Waid and Brian Augustin. Forgive me if I got it wrong, but, man, I owe both of those guys like a drink. I had so much fun writing her.
Who are some of the older writers and artists that that you really enjoyed working with? I saw your really nice tribute to Gil Kane, which I thought was great, and I had no idea that he had done a Static for you, which is really cool.
Oh, he did Static. I worked with him on this book I used to do called Monster in My Pocket, which was not porn. I did Back to the Future with him, and he's always a total professional, really interesting guy, unbelievably well-read. A lot of fun to work with. Between being an assistant editor at Marvel and my early freelance career, I got to work with almost everybody cool I wanted to work with. I never got to work with Kirby.
Okay.
But, you know, I was sitting down the hall from John Romita Sr., you know.
Oh, that's true.
I was getting pages from Walt Simonson. It was just like, it was crazy.
That's really cool, man. And again, I really enjoyed going to your website, too, DwayneMcDuffie.com, and you've got a lot of your old columns up from when you used to write online and just some of your musings. And it was fun to read some of your views on different TV shows and movies. And one thing that cracked me up, because I agreed with you on those first couple episodes, you hated Farscape.
I'm so embarrassed about that. I need to write a column saying that eventually I got it.
I remember
sitting down and watching the first episode of Farscape and thinking, this is like the worst thing I've ever seen.
I understand that. I think you're right.
And now I'm a huge fan. Bought all the DVDs, watched them all, couldn't wait when they did the reunion movie.
Yep.
We had Ben Broder on Justice League.
Yeah, who did he play?
I was so cool. I didn't even act like a fanboy. I was just like, hey, how you doing, Ben?
He was Batlash, right?
He was Batlash.
That's so cool.
Which was particularly fun for me because my all-time favorite TV show is Maverick. And I just decided that for the course of that episode, Batlash was Maverick.
That's smart. And I agree with you. I think Farscape, like a lot of TV shows, you know, they kind of suffer growing pains when they're first starting out.
Oh, I didn't come back for a long time. I mean, I just watched that first episode and went, okay. Yeah, this is like War of the Worlds. I get it. All right.
What do you think of Battlestar Galactica?
Love it.
Great show.
And, boy, was it hard to get. That was another one. Really hard to get me to watch because, you know, the old one, I watched when I was a kid.
Yeah, me too.
Wanting to like it, and it was just terrible.
Yeah.
I actually. It's like, yeah, but it's got spaceships in it. You know?
Yeah, and cool silver robots. No, I know.
Yeah. And no wonder they can't hit anything they shoot at with their eye going back and forth like that all the time. But the new show's really, really amazing. I enjoy it. You know, I'm here on vacation, and I'm trying to get my friend to watch him, and like, she keeps making fun of me, but I'm going to get her.
And I was going to ask also, how about you doing live-action stuff? I know you've written a couple screenplays and specs like that. But you know, are there any bites in terms of?
No bites. Although I don't have a good spec script right now. I really need to kind of get off my butt and do the work I need to do to get to do live action.
Okay.
You know, but I'd love to. You know, shows like The Wire.
Oh, absolutely. Great show.
Early West Wing and Huff. I mean, that's the kind of stuff I'd really love to do.
Well, and again, I think you guys brought that kind of sensibility to Justice League, especially in the fourth season, where you had the season-long story arc.
Yeah, that was nuts, because the whole idea that Justice League was we're going to do, you know, half-hour individual shows, and it just grew. It turned into its own thing.
And mirroring what's going on now in the DC Universe as well. And that's some nice, I think, unexpected synergy, given the lead time that you guys normally have, I would assume.
Yeah, you know, I see on webpages a lot, on discussion groups, where people think that, like, we talk to each other and we know what they're doing. I don't know what's going to happen in Identity Crisis. I bought issue 3 yesterday and just read it this morning, so now I know as much as you do. We really had no idea what they were doing. They didn't know what we were doing, and I think it was just something in the air. We were all thinking about the same stuff with the same characters, so there were a lot of parallels, but we never have any advance notice.
You said you've got Jeff Johns, right? He wrote one of the stories for this.
Yeah, he wrote a story with our version of the Silver Age Hawkman.
Very cool.
Who shows up on the show this year.
I saw one early episode with Carter Hall.
Right.
So you guys are developing that.
There's more to him.
That's cool.
Actually, if you go back and look at that episode carefully, we kind of told you what was happening.
I think I was watching. I think I remember. Was who played Hawkman again? Carter Hall.
Oh.
Isn't it that guy from Quiz Show?
Hang on. James Remar.
Oh, it was James Remar. Okay.
Who was really, really cool. He was also Shadow Thief.
Oh, wow.
Nobody knows.
Oh, that's cool.
He was so different.
James Remar, he's the bad guy in the Cotton Club? And wasn't he just on Battlestar Galactica? He was Richard Hatch's...
He was on Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, he's the guy that Richard... Gear in the Cotton Club, and he was the bad guy in 48 Hours.
And he was in The Warriors. And
of course.
Yeah, no, he's been in a lot of stuff. If you saw him, you'd just go, oh, yeah, him, yeah.
Yeah, that guy. Exactly, that guy. Well, that's the beauty of your guys' show. You guys get these great character actors that, you know, they've got those great distinct voices. Plus, if you saw him, you'd be like, oh, yeah, that guy. I've seen him a million times.
Well, my favorite one of those is Granny Goodness.
Yeah. Tell everyone who it is.
It's played by Ed Asner, who's probably best known as Mr. Grant on Mary Tyler Moore.
And is the creepiest Granny Goodness. Oh, that just what he says, Gary. And you're every cigarette that the man probably ever smoked in his life or drink. That's fantastic. And also, and I heard you mention this on the Comic Zone show, Baron Wunderbar, man, getting Artie Johnson.
Artie Johnson was Roman Wunderbar. That was pretty fun.
Just cool stuff. You know, you remember those bad live-action shows they did in the 70s.
Hey, I got to stay up late to watch them. You're talking about the live-action superhero festival?
Yes, like the roasts and things.
With Hired Man and, yeah.
Oh, well, and I was even thinking of, like, Charlie Callis when he played Sinestro.
That's right.
You know, I work in Chicago radio. We had Charlie Callis. He was in town, and he was in studio. The first words out of my mouth, I'm like, dude, you are Sinestro. I'm like, there couldn't have been better casting.
Did you remember it?
His eyes got wide. He looked at his personal assistant, and he's like, every town, at least two people come up to me and tell me that. He's like, so good. He goes, you're number one. And he goes, I look forward to the next one.
Well, I loved him on Switch, a show nobody remembers.
Oh, yeah. Robert Wagner and Eddie Albert, absolutely.
The coolest kind of cross-casting thing like that we're doing this year is Mark Hamill was going to play the Trickster on Justice League, which is a part that he played on the Flash live-action TV show.
Yep. That's cool.
That was kind of fun.
That's really cool. And Mark's another guy, obviously, that's, you know, I mean, but that's fairly well-known, that is a big comic book guy. And
oh, yeah, huge comic book guy, and, you know, not only is he, like, the definitive Joker, but he's also Solomon Grundy.
Oh, that's neat, because I was reading in the credits to find various people, and I thought they had mentioned that Paul Dini in one of your episodes played Grundy.
No, Bruce Timm did one.
Oh, excuse me, okay, Bruce Timm, okay.
But an episode where he had gone insane and he did nothing but growl, and Bruce is a really good growler. So, I mean, you know, Bruce was Solomon Grundy when he wasn't talking.
Is there anything you want, you know, to mention coming up? Obviously, pick up that Fantastic Four.
That's right. Everybody go buy the Fantastic Four so I can get some more work.
Here, here.
All right, and Justice League will be back. I'm not sure exactly when, but stay tuned. It's worth the wait. It's a really great season.
Well, there you go. Dwayne, everyone enjoys your stories, man, and they enjoy them on TV, and glad to see that you're getting back to comic books, and I think the rest of the publishers need to wake up and hire you for some more books, man.
Oh, sounds good. Thanks for having me.
That's writer Dwayne McDuffie. Visit his website, DwayneMcDuffie.com, and keep your eyes out there because it sounds like he's got a few projects coming up in the comic book world. And that'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Keep coming back to WordBalloon.com for updates on future episodes. Word Balloon is a copyrighted feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2006.